Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. It is July in 2012. And I'm your host, David Katzmeier, coming to you every Thursday night at 8 o'clock in the evening, New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, we have a very special program with author James H. Lee and his new book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. Very excited about this book because it runs parallels with something that I have observed in the changing trends of world cycles. We see before us the decline of the machine age. The Industrial Revolution does seem to be virtually over and declining. We're in the slow aftermath of moving out of our standardized, centralized, production-oriented, growth-dependent society and moving more towards a virtual exchange of ideas, of cultures, and of international trade as the world is becoming flat. We're doing more and more with less and less because we're doing it smarter and smarter. Amid all of this, we have a rising tide of emotional awareness. Emotional intelligence seems to be coming in. As the emotional and intellectual cycles of the world are on the rise, then we are finding smarter ways to be interactive with each other. James Lee tonight will discuss some of the changes that we're going through in this world transformation and how we're replacing the old military-industrial complex model of doing things with social capital as we become interactive with virtual resources and find substitutes to the materialistic, affluent society from which we come. So let me introduce to you our special guest tonight, Jim Lee, and his book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. Hi, Jim.
Good evening. Thank you for having me here. I'm looking forward to our conversation, in part just because a lot of the research that I have done on the investment side suggests that there are some of these reoccurring cycles and that really manifests itself throughout society. So when I ran into your research, I thought that it was very, very interesting. Maybe you can just talk about what you've been doing.
What I've been doing is looking at the fractal relationship of cycles that we find in a person, as we find in a nation, and as we find in the world. An awakening moment for me came back in the 1970s when I realized that there may be such a thing as the biorhythms of the United States. At that time, we were fascinated with the study of biorhythms, a study that goes back into the 19th century with independent discoveries from different professors and doctors in Europe and so forth that found that we have a 23-day physical cycle, a 28-day emotional cycle, and a 33-day intellectual cycle. Well, if we are the models of the civilizations we make up, as was theorized by philosophers like Oswald Spengler and Giovanni Faltista, then indeed we should look for our characteristics to be manifest in our cultures, in our nations. Hence, there is a biorhythms of the United States that lasts for so many years, not days, that there is a physical cycle influencing industry and sports and dance. There's an emotional cycle affecting the mood of speculation or pessimism, whether we're outward and expressive or whether we're introverted. And there's an intellectual high and low reflected in education performance and our ideals and so forth. And these trends move in so many decades and then again in so many centuries for the world. What struck me about the resilience and the future of everyday life is that you're very keen documentation and statistics-supported observations of where we are right now seem to reflect what we are doing in the world as well as anything I've read before. That includes The Future Shock by Alvin Toffler and The Third Wave and Megatrends by John Nesbitt. And now Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life is a great statement of where we are. And once you have that platform and you give us this wonderful mirror to see ourselves collectively, you do so good into projecting into the future.
Yeah, but thank you. I appreciate that. And a map is not necessarily as useful for knowing where you are so much as it is for knowing where you're going.
Indeed.
And at this point, people have just been hearing so much gloom and doom of the news over the course of the last few years that they're really looking for a light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. And they're looking for some direction. They're looking for some vision. And that's what I'm hoping to do with this particular.
Well, Jim, would you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? What led you to this excellent work? It didn't just come out of the blue. You have quite an experience in financial advising.
It's a very broad background. I have been a financial advisor and investment manager now for close to 20 years. And for me, what makes it interesting is really looking at the patterns. And it's the patterns of stocks, commodities, of the markets in general. And there are a number of different disciplines that I use to do that. One, of course, is financial analysis, and that's kind of looking at the reality of earnings and profits and growth. The second is technical analysis, which really gauges investor sentiment over time. And out of the technical analysis came the cycles work and the cycles theory. And what I found out is that that not only applies to the markets, but it applies to social patterns and social trends as well.
Fascinating. So our mood really drives the economy rather than the economy necessarily defining our mood. I mean, there's an interplay, isn't there?
That's one of the principles of socionomics. And you can get a fairly good sense of what's going to happen in the markets if you have a sensitivity to how people are feeling. And I think it would be fair to say that over the course last decade, I had called this the decade of doubt, actually, where you just have a lot of uncertainty, you have a lot of emotional churning, and lo and behold, you have a lot of churning in the markets as well. I mean, we really haven't been anywhere over the course of the last 10 years. It's been an emotional yo-yo, and it's been a yo-yo for the markets as well.
And the market hates uncertainty, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I'm kind of looking at is it feels like everyone's been collectively holding their breath now for years, waiting for something to happen. And we're not quite sure what that is yet, but we have a sense that it hasn't happened yet. And I kind of call that the Wile E. Coyote moment. And, you know, that's like in the old Roadrunner cartoons when Wile E. Coyote runs off a cliff. He sort of pedals with his feet for a few seconds.
Right.
And then realize that he's running on nothing but vapors, and then he falls, you know, at the bottom of the cliff. And we haven't had that Wile E. Coyote moment yet. We feel like it might have happened with Greece, and we feel like it might happen with the euro. It may happen eventually with the U.S. dollar, but it hasn't happened yet. We haven't had that emotional cathartic moment at this point. So one of the things that I found very intriguing about your work in particular are the way that you sort of open up social cycles based on physical cycles, emotional cycles, and intellectual cycles. And for me, this is very much a part of the emotional cycle. So I was curious if you could share with the audience a little bit about where we are right now in that cycle.
I'm in complete accord with you, Jim. I believe that the mood of the people and the thinking drives because you think, you feel, and then that goes to manifest into action. And it's not a coincidence that at the same time that you might find Beatlemania was a craze, that you had more speculation and optimism in the market. It's not a surprise that at the same time we had what's called Generation X, which was a less outwardly, less expressive time, that we also had some contraction in the market. In 1992, for instance, it was the worst year ever for Ford and GM. And we were in a recession at that time, and land values were all very low and so forth. So, I mean, isn't it a coincidence that so many things that we look in our social culture, the width of neckties, the height of dresses and so forth, whether sports cars are red or every car can be any color but black, it coincides with the market.
You know, I find it very interesting that at least in movies and television, we've had a fascination with the undead that started 8 to 10 years ago. And, you know, lo and behold, we've had a zombie economy for about as long.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's that's just one parallel that I'm seeing right now. But I think in a broader sense, and at least looking at some of the work that you've done, you're looking at a 36-year emotional cycle, which, yes, which really peaked right around 2000,
yes,
okay, which was a very happy time for almost everyone.
Yeah.
And then your projections are that that emotional cycle will bottom out around 2018 to 2020 or so.
Yes.
And I find that very interesting.
Well, with the rise of the emotional cycle, it crossed up 1991, bringing us a crisis as it always does when it crosses the middle point. In 1991, it gave birth to an emotional high and the new age that followed, and I'm using the term new age, with a crisis at that time with the brutal beating of Rodney King. And you may remember all of the upset and riots that happened from that injustice to him. It's very interesting when you look 36 years before that, 1955, Rosa Parks was refused a seat on a bus in Birmingham, Alabama, and that led to the boycotts on the Red Arrow Line. So what happens is a high often comes in with an emotionally charged birth, but that gives rise to a new era. That new era brought us a new age, the speculation in the market. It led to the burst in the internet bubble of 1999, 2000, early 2000 is when that came to maturity. But it's interesting that it was in 1999/2000 that the physical cycle crossed up into the high, giving birth to that new era, and we were due for a crisis then.
So this is interesting stuff, because most people, when they look at cycles, they look at the inflection points. They look at the highs and they look at the lows. You actually look at the midpoint. That's the middle of the trend movement as really being the crisis points, the flash points, as it were.
Danger, danger, danger. It's halfway between the high and the low that you're going to have a crisis. And what strikes me when I hear you say, Jim, that we have been 10 years in uncertainty. Remember I said there's a fractal relationship. A nation will move in decades for its cycles, and the world will move in centuries. We'll see the same cycles again in the world, the physical, emotional, intellectual cycles. And right now, what we have happening is there's the 432-year cycle of the world emotional cycle crossing up right now out of the low.
Okay.
Rising up out of the Victorian era. And that is a crisis from 2000 to 2012, leading to uncertainty in the market, leading to the jihads, leading to emotional upset. Remember, emotional cycle is very influential on religion.
Right.
And look at the attacks that happened in 2001 and so forth. So, and also, here's a weird thing. At the same time, the intellectual cycle is crossing up, a 528-year cycle crossing up. That is bringing us a double critical period from 2000 to 2012. And that influences banking and commodities and finance. So I think you could say that during this period in 2008, when we had the collapse in land values, and the entire government of Iceland fell because of this, and we're looking at what's happening in Greece, and we're looking at threats to our intellectual, our financial stability around the world, I'm telling you, it's due. It's the birth pangs of a new era. That's soon to be over. We're in the final year of this crisis, and we're about to move forward. But you say, as you're looking ahead, we have three kinds of ways of looking at the future, Jim. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, futures generally deal with three different types or flavors of a future. And the first is really the probable future, which is what, in all likelihood, we believe will happen. It's sort of a straight line trajectory, as it were. And the discipline that studies that is just forecasting.
Okay.
And the second way of looking at the future is the possible futures and really the range of things that could happen. And for that, the preferred tool is scenario planning. My graduate project was involved in looking at building robust investment strategies that do well across a range of possible futures, including those that were low likelihood, yet high impact.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
So it's a different type of portfolio strategy, but it was a very, very interesting process.
Yeah.
The third type of future that we look at is preferred futures, and that really is something that you can pursue through visioning. And what we've found is that organizations, people, governments do better when they have an end in mind. They know what direction to go in when they know what their destination is going to be. It's just a matter of picking the right destination.
Indeed. So we have probable futures, possible futures, and preferred futures. And if any wise person is going to consider all three as they make any planning. And what's the old saying? To plan for the best and prepare for the worst. I think you're pointing the basic logical way on how to do that. Observe all three.
Absolutely. And you're keeping a broad view of things. The future is not set in stone. There is no monolithic event that's saying this is the future and you can't change it. The world is not like that anymore. We have choice.
Yes, and you're really showing the way in this. You know, you point something out about books on futurism, that really many books on futurism should be printed with an expiration date.
Well, yeah, because we've read so many, and some of the heroes of the future that I follow are Alvin Toffler, certainly, Pierre Thielen-Deschenes, Buckminster Fuller. And all of these guys came out of the 60s and 70s. And that's really when the futurism movement gained traction. And it's really about, I think, creating the future that you want to have happen. So there you have it.
It's nice to see a light at the tunnel, and it's nice to recognize it when it's there. The light is always there. We don't always see it because we don't see in the full spectrum of light. Sometimes the light is going to be seen through our reason, from our learning from experience. And there's a time for looking forward and a time for looking back. 70s, we were looking forward. But right now in the world, we're in crisis of decision. We are in upset. We are afraid. We are reacting maybe a little more than responding, and people are thinking, what's next? We have to get used to the concept that the old paradigm is gone. We all heard the paradigm shift is coming. It's here, baby. We're in it. And this is the birth pangs of a new era.
Well, you got three things here. You have attitude, you have attention, you have awareness. And I tell you, if you're looking for trouble, you're going to find it. And it sort of feels like we've been looking for trouble now for a while. And according to the research that you've been doing, we're in a negative emotional cycle that started in 2000 and ends in 2018, 2020, with it looks like a crossover point right around, this is kind of interesting, 2008-2009, yep. Which is when we had, you know, the financial crisis as we know it. Very, very interesting, insightful stuff, particularly given that you put this together years ago.
In the 70s, okay. And the downward cross from 2009 started the Tea Parties and everything else.
So what I do is I take a look at this emotional cycle that we've been in and really take a look at how we can make the best out of the difficult situation, okay? And really what people are doing to adapt to themselves and their families to an environment of economic uncertainty. Mm. So essentially in a negative emotional cycle, you know, first of all, you're going to have a lot of finger pointing. You know, you're going to have the blame game. You're going to have people looking for other people to accept the blame. Yeah. But if you look back at history, the last time that we've been in sort of this downtrend was actually the 1970s. Okay. Now, I like to say that the end of the world happened already, and it happened in the 1970s.
You say in your book that the last time the world ended.
Yeah, you know, around 78, 79, 80, you know, a time that we would all rather forget. And, you know, at the time, I was a kid, and my parents were kind of getting ready for something. They didn't know what, but they bought the wood stove. They started, my mom, you know, made a lot of her own clothing. She's a seamstress. We started buying things in bulk, and we bought whole new rack systems for the garage so that we could store all of our food. And people were, I'd say, mildly panicked, to say the least.
Okay? Yes.
You know, they're tracking something called the misery index. Every night on the news, they talk about the misery index.
And stagflation.
And what that was the rate of employment plus the rate of inflation, and it hit double digits, and that was bad. And actually, you know, come to think of it, the misery index now is above 10. You know, we have 8 to 8.5% official unemployment plus 2.5-3% official inflation, which on an official level is above 10. And if you look at how the numbers were calculated a decade or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
In all likelihood, the real numbers are probably somewhat higher than that. So if you look at what did happen in the 70s, you had a surge in social experimentation. Okay, you had a surge in innovation in a lot of ways, but you also had a lack of agreement between people as to what we should be doing. It was a crisis era, and we're sort of in that crisis era right now.
Yes.
So what I'm thinking is that a lot of people are going to be getting back to the basics.
Mm.
Okay, they're going to be focusing on really moving away from the household as a center of consumption towards the household as the center of production. We're seeing a lot more people growing their own food, doing their own home improvements, homeschooling their kids. They're trying to get control over their lives. And as part of this, we're seeing a lot of experimentation. We're seeing a lot of social experimentation as well.
Yeah.
So what actually happens is in a down cycle, emotional down cycle, you see people trying out different things, but not agreeing on much of anything. In an emotional up cycle, which we're going to hit sometime around the 2020s, you're going to see people agree on things. You're going to see people moving together, and that's called progress.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you may not necessarily have that degree of diversity or that conversation or conflict or dynamism that we have today.
Exactly right.
So that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've learned as a futurist is that really the view is better at the edge. Okay. And if you look at the edges of the culture, the edges of society, that's where you're going to get a view of what could be happening next. Okay. So it's all about the periphery. There's a science fiction author, William Gibson, who once wrote that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. So the question is, where do you look for the future to be happening now? And the answer is, it's in a lot of these fringe movements.
Indeed. And what starts out as the avant-garde or isolated enclaves may indeed turn out to be the trend-setting method once the cycle changes. And that's the important thing we have to remember. There's a time when we become unified moving forward. Then it's the time when we pull up the drawbridge and look back. And all of these cycles are in play. As we are going through a period of uncertainty, we've got to remember that this uncertainty is going to end. And now is the time to ask what's next. You know, you talk about movers and shakers as we're moving into this less growth-dependent society, and that we're becoming a less more of conspicuous consumption as a status. We're becoming less of the affluent society. You mentioned that we're doing more do-it-yourself and becoming self-reliant, moving away from being consumers to prosumers. In the process, that's changing lifestyles, it's changing the nuclear family, and it's changing the interaction of what is a moving force, that which influences numerous other things, or which is a shaker force, that which is moved by things. And through all of this, the change is bringing about something that you describe as social capital, an intriguing term, Jim. Could you tell us what it means as we're using social capital more than production lines as a means of interacting and developing our methods, our lifestyle and economy?
Yeah, well, the whole social capital idea really came from this idea that what we have seen over the course of the last decade isn't so much a collapse of real estate and financial markets so much as it is a collapse in the public sense of trust.
Mm.
And that is that as we have experienced in a growing and, some might say flourishing economy from 1980, roughly speaking, to the early 2000s, people became more focused on themselves. And they spent less time with their families. They spent less time volunteering in their communities. They spent less face-to-face time, and we glorified the people at the top who were making all the money.
Yeah.
And the result is that we forgot how to do some basic things, and we neglected the relationships that we've had with people in our community.
Indeed. The me generation, you know, it's all about me, you know, baby boomers and so forth. But now we're realizing that our communities are the strong building blocks of society, and we're interacting with them. There's resource sharing, there's time sharing, something that you've described as a way that people can invest their time into a local community project, mm-hmm. and then be awarded with credit of time equity, where somebody else will serve something that they need. Could you describe a little bit about how this social change is being used in resources?
Well, you know, reputation is the new currency. And what we're finding is that there are actually some ways of kind of commoditizing reputation, whether it's silly things like likes on a Facebook page, for example, or the number of followers on a Twitter feed. But I think more fundamentally, one of the things that we need to do as we restructure businesses going forward is to realize that it's not all about profits anymore. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think that businesses need to have three things in mind. One is make money, okay? Another one is have fun, enjoy what you're doing. And the third is just be excellent, be really, really good at what you're doing. And instead of cutting back and laying people off, I think businesses should use whatever extra time or resources they might have during a downturn to spend that time cultivating their relationships with their customers and being sure that they're doing a good job and really taking pride in what they do. So as far as some of the innovations that I'm seeing right now, one of the most interesting ones is the whole concept of time banking. And this really comes up from the fact that people who have a lot of time generally don't have as much money. Mm-hmm. And people with a lot of money don't necessarily have a lot of time.
Time is money.
Right? It is. Well, in this case. So there's a fellow in D.C. Who put together the first time banking program where people can donate hours of their time doing what they do well. It could be babysitting, it could be dog walking, it could be tax preparation, it could be legal advice, it could be teaching Spanish, for example. Hmm. What they do is they treat everyone's hours as equal. Okay, everyone has the same amount of time, and everyone's time is valued the same amount. But what it does is it enables people to volunteer their time, get credits in their account, which they can then exchange for the services for anyone else in their community.
Wow.
And it's had the impact of doing a few things. One is it introduces people to each other. Two, it's really been a very good incubator for people starting new businesses, whether it's hair salons, whether it's tax preparation, whether it's a tutoring business. It gives people the experience and the network that they need to have as beginning entrepreneurs.
Wow. Time banking, an interesting concept. It's social networking manifest, and it's building the local community, whereas your time and your activity is a resource. So it's basically going from consumer to prosumer interactive. And that's building the local community. At the same time, while we're becoming less growth dependent and less materialistic, we're finding ourselves in an international virtual environment of culture and of finance. And so together, while these things are both happening on the local and the global level, this brings a concept that you're developing called glocalism.
Oh, glocalism. Yes, yes. Well, in essence, what we're doing is we're looking at really a split economy at this point. Okay, you have the traditional physical economy, and then you have the emerging digital economy, and they both have very, very different rules. The people who worked in the factories or worked in the traditional economy had the physical economy where you had a workplace, you know, an office where you showed up at every day or a factory. You had a work week. You had your shifts, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever. And then you had fixed jobs that you would stay at for the course of your entire lifetime. And then you'd get a pension, and then you would retire. And then that was it. The digital economy seems to be following different rules. Not only have we seen a disappearance of the workplace, Yeah. We have seen a disappearance of the work week, and we've even seen a disappearance of jobs, of work itself. To the extent that I think now between 30 and 40% of the population in the U.S. is either unemployed, self-employed, or part-time, or contingent, or seasonal.
Yes.
So the 40-hour work week has pretty much all but disappeared, and it's been replaced by something that I refer to as the patchwork queen's quilt, and that is people stitching together a number of different jobs in a way that provides the flexibility and covers for their own needs. That works pretty well for the digital economy, but for the physical economy, that's something different. So the digital economy is global in scope. It's anywhere, anytime, anyhow.
Yes.
The physical economy seems to be getting more localized. And the reason behind that is there are some things that you simply can't outsource. Okay, you can't outsource mowing your yard to Hyderabad, India. That's not going to work.
The commute would be tough.
You also have to mow your yard during daylight hours. Okay, you can't do it at 11 o'clock at night, or it's just not going to work.
I don't know. I had a sundial I used to use at night. I used a flashlight.
Well, then you can get any time you want out of that.
That's true. That was a global
costume. So with globalization, what we're finding is that people are getting stretched in two different directions. They're getting stretched into this international, anytime, anywhere variety, or the digital economy. And the physical economy seems to be getting increasingly localized, whether you're looking at the local food movement, whether you're looking at an interest in restoring what they refer to as slow towns, or doing business locally for just the physical stuff.
Yes. So we have this happening two-tier. The physical level is becoming less mass worldly standardized and more localized as we decline on the physical industrial cycle. And yet what's becoming the international standard is flex time, less labor-oriented, fixed in a location, to allowing people to work part-time, various jobs, and be more virtual. So these two things together is globalization. It's an amazing concept as we move forward. So we're seeing changes in virtually every aspect of our lives, and it's happening in everything. It's happening socially, culturally, emotionally, mentally, physically, and financially. And the concept of futurism has indeed proven true. Alvin Toffler said that we were going to become more flex time. We were going to have the electronic cottage
industries. Yeah.
He predicted that computers were going to be less cold and allow high tech, high touch is what he called it. All of these things that Toffler spoke about way back in the 70s have all come true subsequent to his defining them.
Yeah. And actually, there are two books that are worth mentioning. One is Future Shock, in which he talked about the transitive thrust and the shock of change. The other one's The Third Wave, in which he talked about prosumers.
Yes.
And prosumers are consumers that produce things. And at the time, if you actually read the book, he talks about people writing their own newsletters using photocopiers, okay, and distributing via a network of fax machines.
Yeah.
And that's what people had to work with at the time.
Yes.
But you know, the technology has caught up, and what we're finding is that the internet and the digital age is doing some wonders in terms of distributing power and distributing authority. Okay. And one of the key technologies, I believe, of this decade that's going to kick it up a notch is this whole idea of three-dimensional printing. Okay. So, while data has been becoming decentralized now for a few decades,
yes,
I believe that production may be increasingly decentralized as well. And this has all sorts of interesting implications.
So not only can we self-publish, we can do three-dimensional printing. What is that, Jim?
Yeah. The three-dimensional printing is a relatively new thing. And what you can imagine is you can imagine having a desktop printer. And instead of printing photos or worksheets or Word documents, you print stuff. So the droplets of ink pile on top of each other.
Yes.
To print out either Legos or dishes or plates or clocks. Or with a big enough printer, you can print out whole bicycles. Okay. Or some people are talking about printing out poems using massive printers, each built upon individual droplets of stuff.
So it could be plastic or metal?
Plastic, glass, metal, aluminum, titanium, you name it. There's actually one printer company which can print out objects using 13 different types of materials.
Good Lord.
I've seen printers that can print out entire working clocks without actually having to assemble them.
My word.
And the opportunities, I think, are pretty remarkable. 10 years ago, it was impossible to buy a 3D printer for less than $100,000. Now, they have some home versions that are available for $1,000, $1,200, something along those lines. But what that has the potential of doing is distributing production.
Yes.
And probably making patent lawyers just deliriously happy. because if you combine a three-dimensional printer with a three-dimensional scanner, what you have is a three-dimensional photocopier.
Good Lord.
Which can print anything that it sees. And you combine that with a wireless connection and you have a three-dimensional fax machine so that you can digitize objects at one end and then reproduce them somewhere else entirely. Now, where the prosumers come into this is with this whole concept of customization and design. And that is, you have sort of a new subgroup of people called the makers, which attempt to modify or hack, in this case, physical objects and customize them to their own particular liking.
Yeah.
So we're going to see, I think, things coming out at this point with more creativity, more diversity, probably quicker and faster than we've ever seen it before. We're not necessarily going to be getting all of our stuff from China. 10 or 20 years from now, we're going to be getting it out of our garage, basically.
Good Lord. So the decentralization is allowing for diversity and localization at the same time.
Correct.
With greater skill.
And what happens here is stuff is not as important as it used to be. The important stuff is your creativity.
Creativity.
It's your ability to bring things in the world that didn't exist before. So the whole paradigm is shifting away from the brands, okay, from the big names, to artisanal quality goods. And I'm seeing that right now in food. You're going to be seeing it in clothing. I'm seeing it on the internet with websites such as Artfire and Etsy, where people are beginning to shop for unique items that are handmade by an artisan whom either they haven't met yet or for whom they have some type of relationship. So its status is about story. It's about history. It's about craftsmanship. It's not necessarily about the corporate logo. And that's going to change things a lot into a place.
So the behemoth icons of the industrial century are not leading the ways of now.
They're not. And this is why your work is so interesting, because lo and behold, when we look at your physical cycle, okay, on a global level, the physical cycle using your purview peaked at around 1900.
Yeah.
And that was really the peak of economies of scale, bigger is better,
right?
Big business. Locomotives, big trains, big boats.
That's right.
Farming, you had the plantation model.
You did.
Still running at that point. And this particular rhythm or cycle actually is in decline. It's a declining physical cycle, running to about 2080, 2090, thereabouts.
On the world level, it's going to be after the middle of this century before it hits the bottom on the world level. Because we have the United States cycles, we have every nation cycles, but the world cycle is going to continue to decline.
And the reason why that's happening is I think we're getting smarter matter. Some people call it smatter, okay? But we're imbuing more and more things with a greater level of intelligence.
Yeah.
And you can look at the automotive industry, for example, where you have onboard computers, pretty much in any car that's being built. But I'm
just-in-time technology and manufacturing.
Absolutely, yeah. Just-in-time manufacturing. But some of the other things I'm looking at is smarter materials and material sciences, which I think are going to come out within the course of the next 5 to 10 years, not that far out, which are going to do some amazing things. And the keywords here is one is graphene, which is a new material. It was discovered within the last 10 years. The founders already won the Nobel Prize in physics for this.
Oh.
And what it is very basically is it is a flat sheet of graphite, perfectly flat. And on a molecular level, it looks like chicken wire.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of six-sided structures chained together.
Yeah.
This is not ordinary chicken wire. Graphene is one, superconductive. It conveys electricity without heat loss. It's actually cooling.
No impedance.
It's self-cooling. Yeah, there's low impedance, self-cooling. It's super strong. It's 10 times stronger than steel.
Man sakes.
And 10 times lighter as well.
Whoa.
So this is going to affect coatings. If you cover, say, copper with a sheet of graphene, it takes 7 or 8 times longer to corrode.
Whoa.
Okay. You can use it as a long distance cable, conceivably, if you chain it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And that would enable us to get more power out of our electric grid.
Indeed. Because so much is lost from impedance.
Right. Also, if you can use graphene within the context of an integrated circuit,
yes,
every computer can become a supercomputer.
Oh.
That's self-cooling.
Yeah.
Which saves, again, some energy. So people are trying to figure out how do you work with this new form of matter that can change so many different industries. The same thing goes with OLEDs, organic LEDs, and printable electronics. Okay, so what we're doing is we're infusing, you know, basic plastics with intelligence so that transparent plastics can now be used to display information. They're called TOLEDs, or transparent OLEDs. You're looking at a number of different companies, including DuPont, which is looking at polymer electronics. What if you could print plastic electronics using a printer? Okay. And that opens up a whole bunch of different avenues as well. Another thing that a lot of automotive manufacturers are working on is making cars smarter as well. Autonomous self-driving vehicles will probably be here within 10 to 20 years. And commonplace too. And that's going to change everything.
Wow. That'd save money on hiring a chauffeur, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it sure would. You know, no, that's funny. Because Henry Ford in 1905, a lot of the people in the automotive industry weren't quite sure whether automobiles would really take off because they felt there would be a shortage of chauffeurs. I kid you not. They didn't think that there would be enough people that could actually drive them.
Yes.
You know, under the assumption first that in the backseat would need a hired hand.
Yes.
So this is where some of my work gets kind of interesting, because what I've been doing with this particular cool tool that I call the movers and the shakers is I look at the confluence of different trends. So automated vehicles are part of what I call smarter, faster, stronger. It deals with material sciences, and it deals with infusing everyday objects with a degree of greater intelligence. Another big trend that we have right now is what I refer to as iRobot, or robots are us, which is the desire to automate everything, okay, and sort of get things to do things for us. And we're seeing that a lot in the military with drones, for example.
Yes.
Amazon.com just bought Kiva, which is a robotic system for inventory control.
Oh.
So that Amazon is looking to get away from having people in their warehouses scurrying around on rollerblades, picking up books for you. And instead, they're getting these little robots. They're the size of I don't know, they're discs that are about 2 by 3 feet wide, picking up whole racks and bringing them to the pickers and sorters and doing so in a much quicker fashion.
Yes.
So you have that trend going on, and then you have the trend of the sharing economy, in which the paradigm's moving away from access to ownership. So you have three things here. You have robots or us.
Yeah.
You have smarter materials.
Yeah.
You have the sharing economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one is urbanization. What you get is a future in which cars are not necessarily owned, but they're used for the time in which you need them, and then they go away. Okay?
Huh.
So presently, vehicles that we have, you buy them, and you have to make a big choice. Everyone has the conversation. Do we get a minivan, an SUV, or a convertible?
Yeah. Okay?
And families get a minivan, whether they're taking their whole family to soccer practice or whether you're just going to work by yourself. You still have this one big vehicle.
It's fixed.
It's fixed. And when you're not driving it, it just collects dust in the garage. What can happen as you move towards autonomous vehicles is you order the vehicle that you want for that day. It picks itself up, it drives to your door, and you get it. And you get billed just for the time and the distance that you use it.
Brilliant.
So, you don't need a garage anymore. You don't need as much land.
Yeah.
You're able to save up a lot of parking spaces.
Yeah.
And you're able to fit more cars into a highway.
Sort of a library for vehicles.
It's like a library for vehicles. I mean, people have been in the sharing economy for decades, whether they've used the library, the laundromat, or the video rental store.
Okay? Yeah.
This is not new stuff. Once we get away from our attachment to car ownership, what we get is the whole flexibility and freedom, and I think fun, in that you can get the right car for the right occasion,
yeah,
and you're not paying for something that you're not using. The result of that is it all supports greater urbanization, more people living a little closer together, a little bit more conveniently, and I think a little bit more efficiently from an economic perspective, with a greater level of, I think, as well, personal safety. You're not going to have the automobile accidents that we've had before, and you're not going to have to build out the infrastructure the way that we've been building it out in the last 50 years.
It's true.
So it's really kind of amazing stuff. And I can just, go on for like hours about this. So you have to.
Well, I mean, I didn't realize that the future was here as much as I do now after having read Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life, which anyone can find on Amazon. They find a link to it on your blog. Let's mention your site, Jim.
Yeah. I blog in two different locations right now. I have my personal blog, which is resilience-economics.com.
Resilience-economics.com.
Thank you, Jim. Which is a combination of sustainability and investment strategy. I also blog exclusively about futures trends at the World Future Society. That's at www.wfs.org.
You were a speaker there at one time.
And I will be again. So What I've started doing is putting together a whole new series called Investing in the Future, in which I take a look at some of these emerging social and technological trends and look at all of the different possible investment angles. And I just posted one of those up with three-dimensional printing. I did one a week or two ago on graphene. I'll probably do another one within the next month or two. But it's a really interesting way to get a look at the ecosystems, as it were, of some of these emerging technologies.
Well, I have found resilience-economics.com in some ways is more up to date than tomorrow's newspaper, because its perspective of futurism, you're really revealing how we're becoming virtual in our resources, doing more and more with less and less. And you make frequent updates on here. There's also a link on here on how to find your book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. It's really amazing when you look at all of this. So What do you think is the most important thing for people to set their sights on if they feel a little bit of angst at where we are, or they might lament at how things are not, or they see uncertainty and crisis in decision? When they look ahead, there is the possible future, the probable future, and the preferred future. What should people keep in their minds and their hearts as they look ahead and make their plans?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep your options open and simply just to be flexible.
And that's important.
To look at your priorities. And ultimately, when you look at what's important, it's your families, it's your health, and it's your sanity. Okay. What I'm looking at is really as we go through this transitional period, that social capital is becoming more than financial capital. And to that extent, people are relying upon their families more than ever before to provide them with help and support. And to that extent, I believe that the current transition is going to help people reconnect and rebuild in some very positive ways.
You know, Alvin Toffler agreed with you as he made his futuristic forecast, because he said the machine age had basically divided families, ripped them apart. People moved to be near the factory, and they didn't necessarily have the three-generational households. People were moving to where the jobs were. But as we move into virtual resources, people are now free to choose where do they want to live rather than where do they have to live. We're becoming more local, and that allows for stronger community and community resources.
That's a great point. And what you mentioned is really the trend towards specialization during periods of economic growth, where people do just one thing and they do it really well, versus generalization, where you learn how to do a little bit of everything. And when I look at the trend towards generalization, I think that it has potential to build whole people who are capable, who are increasingly resilient, and that are a little bit happier as well. And such a bad thing.
So when we're not creative, we tend to act like robots. But when we're smarter, we find more creative reasons to build robots.
Yes. And with all of that, with all of the life experience that you get by being a generalist, you also get empathy. You're going to relate to other people better because you've had a taste of their life as well. And that's also part of rebuilding the social capital that we've lost over the course of the last 30 years.
That's so marvelous. So maybe the emotional tide of the world is rising. Maybe we have risen up out of the Victorian era. Maybe we've risen up out of the period of before. It was a physical high with an emotional and intellectual low. And what did we do? We outbuilt our own sense. So what's happening now? The tide is reversing. The heart, the emotional cycle is going up into a new age of romanticism and social capital. And the intellectual cycle is bringing us a new age of reason, so that we can do things smarter as the physical cycle declines, bringing a quiescence of the behemoth clamor and the din of the machine age. So what are we doing? We're fighting the machines and using our minds and caring about each other more. That's why I'm intrigued by your concept of social capital. It's a fascinating observation that you made, and it is indeed our future. It's our present. The future is here.
Yeah, to quote Buckminster Fuller, he refers to this whole as the process of ephemeralization. And ephemeralization is about being able to do more and more with less and less until you can do absolutely anything with positively nothing. And that's the direction that we're moving in.
So it pays. So what's the old expression? Work smarter, not harder.
That's right. That's right.
The world is doing that now.
Results-only work environments. That's right. You get paid for what you do, not for your time.
Then maybe we should have a little song in our hearts and be a little bit gleeful as we look towards a more positive future, taking us away from some of the ills of our recent past. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily see destroying local cultures in favor of getting to the raw resources that are underneath the ground and not caring about who's being displaced
because of it. It's happened in here in America. It's happened in our own colonization of smaller countries. It's happened in Tibet and so forth. You wouldn't necessarily see slavery in favor of plantations in the next two centuries. You're not going to see us poisoning the waters, the air, and the land, and dumping radioactivity in containers that will rust away and leave it to leach under the ground. We're probably going to abate the practice of fracking and so forth, because we are finding ways to do things smarter, and we're not thinking short term as we decentralize, digitize, and become more diverse. So we're probably cleaning up the mess from the night before. It's like picking up the beer cans and the pizza boxes after a big party.
Oh, we've got a lot of work to do. it's a mighty fine mess that we've built for ourselves. And
got that right.
I think we're probably at the hangover stage right now, which is why that movie was so popular, was just because it was a metaphor for everything else that was going on. I mean, it was fun while it lasted, right?
Yeah.
But then you wake up, you have a headache, you're a little grouchy, and you sort of got to burn it off. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Yes. And we are seeing the light. And the light is coming in the way that we're doing things smarter. And this is really exciting when you see this, because we tend to hold on to the past. But right now, anyone who holds on to the past is going to become part of it. It's something you can look back on, something you can learn from. It's great to be nostalgic. But let us also, at the same time, learn the lessons.
Well, what's happening is every generation is dealing with this differently, okay? And my parents' generation, the silent generation, they're not going to have to make a lot of changes, okay? I think it's going to be kind of business as usual for them. The baby boomers are changing somewhat.
Yes.
They're learning to redefine retirement towards this ideal of retooling.
Yes.
And that's where you don't just stop working. You just start working at something you would rather do.
Indeed.
And you do that for a while. The people in my generation, I write about this in the book, are really what I refer to as the homesteaders. They're the people that are doing the micro farming and the homeschooling and the entrepreneurship and the small businesses, in part because the baby boomers are preventing them from rising within the corporate ranks. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is a glass ceiling right now for Generation X. And they can't break through, which is why so many of them are starting their own businesses at this point. And then you have the Generation Ys, the millennials, which came of age right around the turn of this particular millennium. And they are changing into something entirely different. And they're what I refer to as the first post-consumer generation.
Ah.
And the way that they're adopting is really by not making long-term commitments, and also by minimizing their footprint and by minimizing their financial obligations as well. So every generation has a slightly different psychology, slightly different coping mechanism, which they're customizing based upon their own needs.
So we're becoming more virtual, and our footprint is lessening as the physical cycle declines. And our creativity rises as the intellectual cycle rises, and our compassion and social capital is being employed as the emotional cycle rises. We are becoming social beings. We're not just becoming automatons that don't care about the consequences of short-term gains. I'm really excited about where we're going. I think that we just need to keep our eyes set on the horizon and realize that among the probable future in the possible future, there is the preferred future, if we make it so. So, Jim, I'm thank you for sharing this time with us, and I invite everyone to do what I've done. Go out to Amazon, go to Jim's site, resilience-economics.com, and look for Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. Keep up with his blog, because the future is happening now, and it's coming to a neighborhood near you. We are the seeds to the future. We're the culmination of the transitional period right now. In a transition, you can find that it's either castles that are crumbling or the birth pangs of a new era. Jim and I will both suggest to you that the transitional period that we're in now is the birth pangs of a new era, an era that hasn't been defined,
an era that we will create. Look forward, look for the horizon, look within yourself, find the compassion and the creativity and manifest it, because that is the greatest capital of your own future. Andy Warhol doesn't need to paint a Campbell's soup can as an icon of what we're centralizing on. He might paint a portrait of us all. And that's where we are in the cycles. And that's where we may be going, as defined in Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life by James H. Lee. Thank you for joining us. Look back to blogtalkradio.com/cycles for this show and others. Thank you again. You done right good, I figured.
Good. That was good.
See, we needed a rehearsal.
We did. We did.
Hot damn.
That was good.
Okay.
Very nice. Very nice. So much more conversational.
It was interactive. It was informative. We knew what to hit on.
Right. It's good.
All right, then. Most righteous, sir. Got one for the archives. I think people are going to find it interesting. Sure. And you speak well. You handle it. I mean, you're so easy to understand. You know, a lot of people who have your history and accomplishments, and particularly in such a technical field as finance, they're eggheads. And
I can do that too.
I think you have done that. I think you've done it for years. What's amazing is that you also speak English.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare for somebody in your field.
Right.
Don't need a translator. that's right.
I'm just having a great time connecting the dots between your physical cycles and defeminization and emotional cycles and your structuring.
When you look at the world cycle and you see that the physical is declining, the emotional and intellectual is rising, and then you look at the changes that we're going through, it seems to all fall in. It seems that you can see the intellectual cycles, creativity, yeah. The social capital.
I can't tell you what the emotional cycle balance I would be in 100 years, which would be very interesting.
What would you see of that as being?
It has to do with the kind of human empathy.
Yeah.
Through overcoming traditional physical limitations. And essentially, as we start to incorporate more machine intelligence within our body, okay, you know, getting an always-on internet connection.
Yes.
Or having replaceable body parts and organs.
Talk or spoken about that. It'll be harder to define what's human and
machine. It starts to get very blurry, but what it does is it may create a certain degree of impatience and tolerance for people that have not kept up with their upgrades, for example.
Ooh.
Okay. So
all natural versus the new and improved.
Exactly. So that's the whole thing of post-humanism.
We could tamper with our own genetics.
You upgrade yourself out of being empathetic.
Look out for the obvious, you know, the obsolescent human beings.
Right, yeah, that's really the obvious.
Purely biological units.
So, you know, that particular emotional cycle, when you pick it up around 2100, and we'll be about on track for that in 100 years. And, you know, if you thought updating your computer was bad for Microsoft Windows, you're going to have to update your leg, you know, or your hands, you know, need to have their systems debugged.
But will I occasionally be able to control alt delete my life?
you'll be able to selectively forget some things.
Oh, that's dangerous.
You can edit your
memories.
Philip K. Dick wrote all about that when he was writing his books. It's real versus found memories.
So
real versus reconfigured memories.
High tech confabulation.
Yeah, he wrote that stuff in the 50s, which was amazing. So
good Lord.
So there is such a thing as being able to make some good calls in the world of futures. Well, yeah. If you like, we have a few minutes. I can take you downstairs and show you what I'm reading.
Yeah, a few minutes would be all we need. We get to hear if the quality came through. I
mean, I'm still a little bit in suspense about that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out.
We'll find out. So.
All right. Let me toss this cord in here. Yeah.
I'd like to go down and take a look. See.
Yeah.
Well, I'm getting a free lesson in futurism.
I got books all over the place.
Let me stash this up where I'm not going to lose it. I'm so glad that interview didn't work yesterday.
I do.
That's not. Okay, good luck.
I would love to.
Here I come. I'm going to put the volume up all the way and just click play, and then we can go downstairs. And then we'll still be playing.
Yeah,
okay.
We thought that was a cat.
I don't know if it's actually archived yet. Last time it took about 3 minutes.
Yeah. I'll send this out to my publicist because he wants some more links so that I can get on some other radio shows, which he's trying to book up for me. And part of the problem of getting the word out was 2 months ago I had no book. Then I had no speeches. Then I had no interviews. And I'm trying to...
Now you're doing them all.
Yeah. Fill in the blanks.
So when's your next talk coming up?
I'm doing one up in Kennett this Sunday.
Oh, that's when I go to New York. We're going to be up there for a week.
I'm going to be up there. And then after that, I have some signings.
Are you posting all of those engagements on your site?
Yeah, they're in the events section. So people can see kind of where I am.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, okay, I don't hear anything yet, so we'll just give a little bit, and I'll test it out at home, give you a call, let you know how it
goes. Yeah, I can test it out from here.
Go blogtalkradio.com forward slash
site. That was good. I think this worked out really
quite fun. That rehearsal, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Just a little self-awareness.
Here are events.
Oh.